is to gradually change things over there. Various Microsoft people echoed these sentiments and added to the picture of how systems differed from applications. There is even a geographical explanation. The applications groups are located in the more modern northern part of the Microsoft campus, with a road separating the big fancy brown buildings and the southern suburbs down here, as Dave Moritz described the setting. Despite the relatively greater affluence of the applications division, however, Gates maintains his office with the systems people. The different technical natures of the products play a major role as well. But this too is changing, as user interfaces and features become more important in operating systems. Chris Williams, the director of product development, expected systems people to come around slowly as they gain more experience. People in systems still feel that we will sell no wine before it's time, and so their approach to developing software is completely different. I think you have to have lived through 3 or 4 project cycles to have gone through the pain of a badly managed process several times. And if you think about the people who are working in systems, their cycles are twice as long as they are in apps. The guys who are coming off NT are the guys who are coming to me now saying, "I cannot take this one more time." And of the guys who are in Chicago, Windows 95, I'm convinced there will be a certain percentage who will come to me when that thing ships and go, "I cannot take this." That's a fundamental difference. I also think the difference is that the people who are in charge of those projects are people who have succeeded. Windows 3.1 was arguably a fairly successful project, and these are people who have succeeded at creating software in the old-fashioned way. And it is not broken, as far as they're concerned. So why are you trying to fix it? New markets and technologies. Microsoft does not only make operating systems and applications programs, even though these areas generate most of the company's current revenues and profits. The fastest-growing markets are new consumer products and online systems. These divisions have yet another culture, more concerned with mixing leading-edge science and technology with everyday consumer habits. Group Vice President Nathan Myhrvold, who has been head of advanced technologies in Microsoft, described his 3 charters in a recent interview. 1. Help Bill Gates set technology strategy for the company, such as making decisions on what technologies to license, buy, or develop. 2. Create products for the future. And 3. Conduct research, focusing on areas of computer science that support Microsoft's product groups and Gates' vision for extending the personal computer. In a broader sense, Myhrvold saw his role as preparing Microsoft for paradigm shifts, such as that which seems to be occurring in digital information. A classic problem is that companies have one product that they do really well with, but they never move beyond that. What's distinguished Microsoft is that we're not afraid of making paradigm shifts, largely because our senior management is very technical. We understand the technology, which at the end of the day is really what drives the industry. You have to be very smart in business, but no amount of smarts will protect you from a technological revolution. It can overthrow you in a minute. The Advanced Consumer Systems Division, now part of the Platforms Group, has been particularly important. In cooperation with the research, broadband applications, and online systems areas, the Advanced Consumer Systems Division develops and markets multimedia products for the home and the information highway. These include interactive TV and the Microsoft Network. It also works on futuristic products. The division has a similar functional structure to other product units, i.e., people have assignments in program management, development, testing, and product planning. Job responsibilities are less distinct among the functions, however, to promote innovation and exploration of new ideas. Rick Rashid, a former Carnegie Mellon professor of computer science, runs research, including interactive TV studies. His group has about 250 scientists and an annual budget of at least $150 million. Its work targets new technologies 5 to 10 years from commercialization, but also includes projects with shorter-term potential. Researchers are studying programming productivity tools, applications of artificial intelligence to operating systems and user interfaces, computer-based decision-making, speech processing and understanding, supercomputer design, video on-demand server technology, and different approaches to mixing video, audio, and text to create interactive TV, multimedia products, and pocket information systems, such as a wallet PC. Rashid explained that Gates feels Microsoft is now big enough to afford to have a research group and fund it lavishly. Gates and others also believe that Microsoft must generate more of its own technologies. Basically, Bill wants to see an organization that pushes specific areas of research. We want those groups to be world-class and to be as good as or better, preferably better, than any of their competitors in their particular research arenas. Bill views this as a long-term commitment. It's something that Microsoft is able to do because it has reached a certain point in time and a certain size. It's also increasingly important because the company has to be able to develop its own ideas and its own technology to really prosper in the future. Besides, it never hurts having smart people around. The new research division has already contributed significantly to the new online service, new operating systems such as Windows 95 and Windows NT, and new user interfaces that provide intelligent assistance and make Windows easier to use for novice consumers. Myhrvold and Rashid are both confident that Microsoft will eventually produce whole new generations of technologies and products. They hope their research division will also outdo previous central labs at leading companies. Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, for example, pioneered but did not successfully commercialize the personal computer and graphical user interface. IBM also has had difficulty commercializing computer technologies its researchers invented, such as reduced instruction set computing, RISC. Rashid explained why they are so confident. The problem with Xerox PARC was not a problem with PARC. It wasn't that they were doing anything wrong. They were doing just exactly the right things. The problem was that they were working in a copier company. And I think that's really the lesson that you get from all these things, that the research has impact in the areas that it's performed if the company is operating in those areas. Then it can take advantage of that research. Myhrvold added that, unlike in these other companies, Microsoft ties its research directly to the heart of the company, to the CEO, and to strategy. Another problem with older labs is that they suffer from the ivory tower syndrome. They're completely separated from everyone else. I report directly to Bill Gates. Bill's very involved with our group strategy, and I'm involved with the strategy we do elsewhere in the company. Gates has been reported to spend as much as a third of his time working with Myhrvold on futuristic product ideas. Principle: hire the smartest managers you can find, people with a deep understanding of the technology and the business. The senior Microsoft managers we have already talked about, Bill Gates, Mike Maples, Steve Ballmer, Nathan Myhrvold, Paul Moritz, Pete Higgins, Chris Peters, Rick Rashid, and others, may have their weaknesses, but they are clearly very able in ways important to Microsoft. In fact, Gates and other managers frequently boast that they hire only smart people, managers as well as developers, testers, and others. But what does being smart mean? To Bill Gates, this means being able to understand and probe complex things quickly and creatively, as he explained in a 1994 interview. There's a certain sharpness, an ability to absorb new facts. To walk into a situation, have something explained to you, and immediately say, well, what about this? To ask an insightful question, to absorb it in real time, a capability to remember, to relate to domains that may not seem connected at first, a certain creativity that allows people to be effective. Gates himself exhibits these qualities and looks for them in potential Microsoft managers and employees. As Microsoft has grown, Gates has personally interviewed hundreds of programmers, managers, and technical experts who complement and challenge his own skills and knowledge. From this group, he has cultivated a relatively small core of senior people that serves as an informal brain trust to assist him in making decisions and overseeing critical projects or initiatives. Gates, though, has a tendency to promote programming experts into senior management at very young ages. Combined with very rapid growth, this has left Microsoft short of managers in the middle ranks who understand not merely the technology in the business, but also the human side of management. The Brain Trust. The core of Microsoft's Brain Trust consists of around a dozen people. They run the key product areas and new initiatives, as well as constitute an informal oversight group to critique what everybody else is doing. There are also senior technical people working in the projects who are part of a broader network. Although many of these people are Microsoft veterans from the founding years, a growing number have come from competitors or are experts in new technical domains that go far beyond the PC. Dave Moore, who does not consider himself a member of the inner circle, I'm more modest than that, described it as a group of people not listed anywhere, but widely recognized for their exceptional knowledge and experience. It's fairly informal. The one thing I would say that makes you part of the Brain Trust is your ladder level. Every developer has a ladder rating. Each of the functional disciplines, development, testing, program management, user ed, they each are on their own ladder levels. People associated with the Microsoft Brain Trust include the company's most senior executives, as well as top developers and program managers. Among the executive staff, there is Executive Vice President Steve Ballmer, age 39, a classmate of Gates at Harvard, who studied management at Stanford for a year before joining Microsoft in 1980. He may not be the right person to manage the systems divisions today, but he goes where the challenges are. Successfully taking over Windows development when this project was mired in delays during the mid-1980s, and recently taking over sales and customer support as these areas have become more critical. There is Group Vice President Nathan Myhrvold, age 36, a Princeton University PhD in physics who studied with Nobel Prize winner Stephen Hawking and joined Microsoft in 1986 when Gates acquired Myhrvold Software Company. Myhrvold has been leading the way into corporate networks, multimedia, telecommunications, and online services. Group Vice President Pete Higgins, age 37, came to Microsoft in 1983 after obtaining a Stanford MBA. He formerly headed the Desktop Applications Division, and now, with Myhrvold, manages the new Applications and Content Group. Group Vice President Paul Moritz, age 40, a Microsoft veteran since 1986, specializes in long-term product strategy and oversees the development of Microsoft's operating systems as well as other key consumer technologies. We should add to this group newcomer Robert Herbold, age 53, a PhD in computer science from Case Western Reserve University, who worked in Procter & Gamble for 26 years, most recently as senior vice president in charge of management systems, market research and advertising, and technology acquisitions. He joined Microsoft in 1994 and brings a deep expertise in consumer marketing, important to Gates because consumer products are Microsoft's fastest growing area. Several other senior executives fall into the Brain Trust category. Senior Vice President Brad Silverberg, age 41, manager of the Personal Operating Systems Division, came to Microsoft in 1990 from Borland and headed the Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 projects. Roger Heinen, age 43, senior vice president in charge of the Developer and Database Systems Division, entered Microsoft in 1993 after heading Macintosh software development at Apple and working at Digital Equipment Corporation before that. James Alchin, age 43, vice president and head of the Business Systems Division, leads the Cairo Windows NT 4.0 project. He came to Microsoft in 1991 from Banyan Systems. Senior Vice President Craig Mundy, age 46, responsible for advanced consumer systems, joined Microsoft in 1992 after managing a supercomputer company, Alliant Computer Systems. Jonathan Lazarus, age 44, Vice President of Strategic Relations, is a marketing specialist who joined Microsoft in 1986. Vice President Chris Peters, age 36, heads the Office Product Unit, which has generated nearly half of Microsoft's sales and profits. Vice President Rick Rashid, age 43, head of research, joined Microsoft in 1991 after being a well-known professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University. Rashid is the chief architect of Mach, a Unix-based operating system that served as one of the models for Windows NT. Daryl Rubin, age 41, vice president for software strategy, is an expert in network technologies and a Microsoft employee since 1986. Although his influence has diminished as new people have come on board, another member of this select group has been Charles Simoni, age 48, a Stanford PhD in computer science who designed graphical applications for Xerox PARC, including the famous Bravo word processor. He left Xerox for Microsoft in 1981, and for much of the next decade directed Microsoft's entry into applications, beginning with Multiplan, Word, and Excel. Some members of this group are clearly on a faster track than others. Silverberg had this to say about one youthful colleague. Chris Peters is the guy who understands the development process the best, who has had the most success, who has the development process most people in the company want to emulate. He's the guy we think we can learn the most from. Like other top managers in Microsoft, Peters has a solid technical background, but he also has broader than usual experiences in the company, having worked in systems, applications, and general management. He has both bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering from the University of Washington, where he specialized in software engineering. After coming to Microsoft in 1981, he worked as a programmer on MS-DOS 2.0, the Microsoft Mouse 1.0, PC Word 1.0, and Windows 1.0. For 5 years, he was the development manager for Excel. After the successful shipment of Excel 3.0, just 11 days late, as a result of using the new development process, Peters became general manager of the Word product unit, a business that generated several $100 million in revenues for Microsoft. In 1993, Peters received the title of vice president when he took charge of the new Office product unit, now the key to Microsoft's application strategy for desktop PCs. Another essential member of the Brain Trust has been Mike Maples, age 53, who served as executive vice president between 1988 and 1995. He is now an advisor to the company on such matters as mergers and recruiting. Maples is important because he gently but steadily nudged Microsoft further down the path of greater structure and less chaos in product development. He was not a developer, but he had the background to be one, with a college degree in electrical engineering from the University of Oklahoma, as well as an MBA. He also seemed to know how to manage creative technical people who do not like a lot of managers above them. Maples left IBM because of the potential he saw in Microsoft, as well as his disappointment with IBM. Within Microsoft, he tried to help Bill Gates avoid the pitfalls of large bureaucratic organizations by emphasizing four general precepts that worked well in IBM. Maples recalled that the first was to introduce in Microsoft a full set of personnel management practices covering hiring, training, compensation, and career paths. One of several things that IBM did really well and that I think we continually improve on is personnel management and management practices. The whole idea of having a level of consistency in terms of the way you measure, monitor, and reward people. Nobody likes to be formulaized into a review system or a management system or an increase system, but what ends up happening is people playing favorites and trying to keep everything in their heads. We were a size where that was starting to break down. It had probably started to break down a lot worse than we had even recognized at the time. So we started the whole idea of moving people between groups and of having some guidelines and a philosophy of how people progress in pay and a definition of levels. Dave Moore has spent a lot of time working on what it means to be a D10 developer and an 11, and what it takes to get promoted, and how we ingrain that in everybody's mindset so that when we move people across projects, there are not huge disparities in pay, in expectations, or whatever. A second precept, which remains a Microsoft weakness, was to nurture middle managers. The other thing we spent more time on was management development, retreats, managers' meetings. A lot of time they're a waste of time, but everybody gets together and talks, and you have that opportunity to talk about common problems. A third was to continue cultivating functional expertise, such as in development and testing, but to make sure people move around and receive broad experiences. Maples wanted to avoid the narrow mindsets and departmental rivalries and turf battles that have plagued IBM and many other large organizations. The other thing that has happened is that people are much broader now, and it's not the developers against the testers. Anytime you have a functional organization, you always have these boundaries, and there gets to be quite a lot of animosity. In fact, it gets to be so bad that some people can never cross them. They have to change jobs or leave. I think we have a lot less of the testers are bums and the developers are good, or the developers are bums and the marketing guys are good. Each team is much more cohesive. We still do have a system that is slightly biased toward developers in terms of levels and pay and prestige. You walk a little taller if you're a Microsoft developer than if you're anything else in Microsoft. And I guess that's the way it ought to be. That's our culture. We're a technically driven company, and most of the senior people in Microsoft are technically grown people. Maples, in particular, tried to avoid the type of culture that prevailed at IBM, where there were many internal conflicts, and groups would hide bad news from management or the quality assurance people. Bill Gates does not like to hear bad news either, and some Microsoft managers have been reluctant to admit errors or slips in schedules, but Gates can be even nastier in meetings when he discovers problems that no one told him about. Maples liked frequent, frank communications aimed at constructive mutual criticism and learning how to do things better. Despite his more confrontational style, Gates has similar values. He wants openness, especially if there are serious problems in a product under development. He wants people to think about what is good for Microsoft, and not just for their own project or their own careers. And neither Gates nor Maples like to see people repeat the same mistakes. Maples compared the atmosphere in IBM to what he has seen in Microsoft. At IBM, there were quality assurance people, not nearly as many people as we have here, and it was much more of an audit function. The development organization did some testing, and then there were the quality assurance guys who were always telling them that they're screwed up. We don't have the kind of adversarial roles that IBM had. IBM had a conflict management system on purpose. If you let people represent their specific interest, then you'll get all the facts on the table and make better decisions. To some extent, that's certainly a valid management idea. We don't do that. We try to get better consensus and have people think broadly what's good for the whole. When I was in development at IBM, you just learned how to hide stuff from them. And you'd go to the very last minute before you'd bring bad news. You'd end up with some really bad tragedies. Things just go against you, or you don't have the experience to bear the risk right. And then all of a sudden, a project that everybody thought was going great just totally bombs. We're much more all cards up, very flat communication. I'll get an email from one of the Word developers that'll say, this thing is going screwy down here, or whatever, and that's not thought of as being anti-Microsoft to communicate. Maples's fourth precept was that a software company should define a process for product development. If you're in IBM, you realize there is value and there are problems with process. The idea of having a process is important. The idea of having one that works for the particular organization or the particular unit is important. Maples recalled that, following the 1989 retreat, he and other senior people decided each team could define their own process as long as they know what it is and they follow it. He wanted to see evidence of a repeatable development process but would not try to define standards for all of Microsoft to follow. Key people in each of the business units then went off and tried to write down how they could best develop and test software. Over about a year and a half, a consensus started to emerge. People still feel they have some degree of freedom in terms of how they run their projects, but I'd say that there are really a couple of basic ways that we do things, and these have permeated throughout the organization. A few basic principles, and that's pretty much what has driven it. Maples listed his common principles. As with Gates's list, we include them in our later discussions. 1. Let people do their own schedules. 2. Build in buffer time for the unforeseen delays that always occur. 3. Assume change will happen, so don't waste time trying to write a complete specification up front. 4. Manage by milestones, starting with the most difficult things first. 5. Focus on customer problems, not technologies or processes. 6. Move people around to mix the good and the bad. Technically competent managers. Gates and other early executives in the company have made a special effort to populate Microsoft with technically competent managers, especially, but not exclusively, in the development organization. Rick Rashid, when still a neutral observer and accustomed to dealing with bright computer science students at Carnegie Mellon University, recalled being struck by the senior people he met. One of the things that I was very impressed with when I first visited Microsoft was the level of expertise and competence that you find basically all the way through the management hierarchy. It's just not that common in the computer industry to find strongly technical people in key management positions throughout the company. Dave Thompson, who had bachelor's and master's degrees from Cornell University and worked in DEC and Concord Communications for 13 years before joining Microsoft in 1990 to head the Windows NT Network Design Group, echoed this sentiment. I believe that one of the strengths of Microsoft is the fact that its managers are very technical, even at the most senior levels. I believe that managers should be as technical as possible. Leads, that is, first-level line managers, absolutely should write code, should be able to fix problems in the stuff that their people develop. It is common practice for managers in all the functions to continue doing their functional jobs after becoming senior managers. Even development managers of large groups, such as Word and Windows NT, still spend one-third to one-half of their time writing code. The rationale is that managers need to remain directly involved in the technology in order to make the right decisions and solve problems that occur in their groups. Lou Perizzoli, software engineering manager on the Windows NT 3.0 project, spends about half his time coding. He makes managers under him do the same. I have these rules in my group that I try to follow. Number one is everybody who works for me actually has code responsibilities, so nobody just manages people. I find that people who manage people lose sight of what the goal is, and they don't appreciate the problems and issues, and they don't act on them quickly enough. Yet, when you have code that you are doing, you tend to act on issues in a much more timely fashion, and you tend to be more concerned about how things are going. I probably spend 50% of my time looking at problems and writing code. Managers in the applications area, such as Chris Peters, speaking when he was the general manager of the Word unit, have similar values. At Microsoft, the functional managers still spend a great deal of their time doing whatever they do. In other words, the development manager of a group of 60 developers will still spend a fair amount of his time programming. In larger organizations, they keep pushing down the level where people are actually doing the work. Pretty soon, you get a development manager who decides that he's way too important to program. And pretty soon, the feature team leads all decide that they're way too important to program. Pretty soon, the programmers are way too busy to program. I have 270-some people working for me, and I'm the first layer in the organization that actually doesn't have to do any work, although I did write one feature in the new version. Weaknesses in middle management. One consequence of promoting successful technical people into the management ranks and encouraging them to continue working in their technical areas is that managers may not spend enough time being or becoming good managers of other people. A common disdain for formal training and promotion systems and for staffs and written procedures, all of which can support the management process, has not helped the situation in Microsoft. The key problem, in Dave Moritz's view, is Microsoft's habit of choosing managers for their technical ability, not for their managerial ability. Management at this firm sucks. I had promotions when I didn't know I had a promotion. I suddenly saw a salary increase, and it happened. There have been times when I haven't even had a review because my manager has been scared of me. There is a problem at Microsoft at the middle management level. Salary increments and bonuses and the one-on-one process is lacking, in my opinion. The managers are picked because of their technical ability, because they've all worked up through the ranks after being hired in as developers, and the best developers become the top managers. Moritz agreed with others in the company that technical managers need to have superb technical skills, otherwise Microsoft people will not respect them. But he also argued that managers need to be more than just excellent programmers. They should exhibit qualities of leadership and charisma, which Moritz said he encountered too infrequently among Microsoft's middle management corps. To be a manager or a leader, in essence, a manager is a leader, you have to have one of two essential things. If you've got both, then you are just set for life. One is you have to be technically as competent, if not better, than your peers or the people you're going to manage. Two is charisma. And generally, the managers at Microsoft are not the charisma types. I regard myself as a charisma type, not a technical type. I am unusual at Microsoft in that respect. At the first line level of management, you'll see a lot of non-charisma types. Those that bump up to the second level will be the ones that have both the charisma and the technical abilities. And so it goes, higher and higher up the levels. When you get to about the third and fourth line up, you generally have people who can manage people well, in addition to managing the technical concepts well. Maples admitted that he learned about this problem shortly after he joined the company, and he maintained that he, with Dave Moore and others, worked hard to improve the situation. But Microsoft grew so quickly that Gates and Maples had to put very young people in positions of great responsibility. And Microsoft's senior executives continue to promote people with technical backgrounds and successful records in technical achievement. Richard Barth acknowledged that finding suitable middle managers is the biggest challenge in the company. No question that we do not have a good set of middle managers. The Chris Peters of the organization are great managers, and that's another one of Mike's agendas, to create more managers. But our biggest challenge is finding the appropriate set of middle managers. They don't just happen. One of the things we have discovered over the last couple of years is that you've got to value and cultivate management skills. The culture of Microsoft has been, if you yell loud and push hard, you were a manager. And again, just in the last year, I've seen that change. In the past, if you were somebody who could really get things done, you were a manager. That's no longer enough. Principle. Hire the smartest employees you can find, people with a deep understanding of the technology and the business. As we discuss in the next chapter, to find people with good technical abilities and a desire to make money using those abilities to build and sell software, Microsoft has instituted a hiring process that rigorously screens candidates. In particular, recruiters look for people who fit into each functional specialty and who can work together well in small teams. Managers generally try to find young people who can adapt to Microsoft ways. They also look for people with the ability to act and learn on their own, as well as make good decisions quickly, without a lot of formal training and written rules or guidelines. But there are both positives and negatives to bringing together so many bright and independent-minded people. The benefits of smart people. Below the product groups and functional managers, Microsoft has approximately 5,000 software developers and test engineers. In a field where the best software programmers may write 10 to 20 times more code in the same time as the least productive members of the same team, attracting talented people is a great advantage. It means that the apparent resources available to managers with a high percentage of talented people are far greater than simply the number of bodies they command. We can think of a contrast to many companies building software systems in the United States, Europe, and Japan, who do not screen software developers so rigorously. Many companies also hire people of various backgrounds and minimal experience with computers, then train them in-house to write software. It is difficult for these people to perform well and be smart in a complex technology when they have such limited experience and training. In fact, every Microsoft manager that we talked to about this subject emphasized the value of having a highly selective pool of people. Mike Maples noted that the quality of the people is an unmeasurable benefit. Not everybody has the luxury we have of getting MIT's best and Stanford's best. Rick Rashid agreed. There are more good, smart software developers here than I've seen any place else in the world, concentrated in one place. So did Dave Thompson. The big difference between us and other companies is the people that we hire. Our whole system is predicated on the fact that our people are very fast and smart. It makes you feel like you have a much larger set of resources to work with. You feel like you have flexibility when you have people that can fix things in hours instead of days. As Bill Gates boasted, "We benefit from having the smartest people actually get involved, not just in the design and ideas, but actually the code itself. They know the code extremely well, and large areas of the code. It's good to have one person who can think through any kind of design change, particularly when you're late in the process and you're trying to be very careful. They can review anything that goes on. They've got a very strong model in their head for what side effects that change might have. We have the benefit that people don't like to have bad developers around. It's just enough of a drag on them that they'll find a way to convince people it's a bad match to be in here if you're not a really top-notch developer." In addition to providing an abundance of sheer technical skills, smart people can make even a large company seem relatively non-bureaucratic and flexible, more like a small company. Chris Peters held this view, emphasizing the value of people who can work and solve problems on their own. This is not a company where there's a bunch of stupid people running around, and then some manager writes down a bunch of stuff in order to control stupid people. It's a company where there's a lot of smart people running around, all trying to do the right thing. I've seen stupid companies where they just hire bodies and attempt to make up for their hiring of lots of bodies by putting in lots of rules. I guess it may partly fix the problem, but the root cause of the problem was not lack of rules. It was hiring people that needed lots of rules to do their job. Given the type of people that Microsoft screens for, it is not surprising that the company culture emphasizes technical competence and shipping products rather than adhering to rules and regulations, respecting formal titles, or cultivating skills in political infighting. Dave Moore commented on this. "Titles aren't important in the company. What's always been important is shipping products. How many products have you shipped?" Brad Silverberg added that authority and responsibility tend to move toward those people who demonstrate the most competence. Another key point about Microsoft development is that the balance of power within each group is more a reflection of the individuals and the strengths and capabilities of those individuals than any cookie-cutter approach. We're flexible. If I hired a development manager who was a super, super great product guy who knew how to make features, balance of power can go over there. I'm certainly not religious about it. I just adapt to the strengths of the people I have. If a conflict emerges between individuals or groups, such as over which components to share, Gates often steps in as the final arbiter. John Fine, formerly a director of program management and currently group program manager for Excel, offered this view of Microsoft's culture and the role of Bill Gates. "Things get done around here in many ways, from the most informal ear whisperings to the most formal orders. Rules don't count. politics does not reign supreme here. So it is certainly not unthinkable for, say, the business unit manager of one piece of software to talk to the business unit manager of another piece and say, you know, maybe our software should be inside of your software, or something like that. That is not a political gaffe. It's just another tactic in order to get the job done of benefiting the industry the most, therefore making the most money. But because those decisions are very costly in opportunity and have such a huge potential for negative effects if they're wrong, of course, they'll end up with Bill. In that way, the traditional management tree is used. The negatives of smart people. The negative side of hiring people who do not want or need rules to work is that these people often have to learn by painful trial and error. It was our impression, for example, that Microsoft developers and testers, with some exceptions, were not so well read in the software engineering literature and often reinvented the wheel, belatedly discovering good practices for software development other companies had recognized as important years ago. These include doing more careful design reviews and code inspections, as well as paying more attention to architecture and designs, sharing components, and having better quantitative metrics and historical data for project management. It is also difficult for senior managers, including Bill Gates, to tell these smart people what to do. They do not always like to cooperate and compromise, or share what they create and learn. As we discuss in Chapter 6, Microsoft has made some progress on this dimension, but there is much more that the company can do. Mike Maples gave one example of the problems he saw when he first joined Microsoft. There weren't many people who had experience in project management. Things were just done loosely. The Microsoft people and the Microsoft culture was such that you had very smart people. They don't want to be told what to do, but they're willing to be allowed to discover what to do. And so you figure out the approach to let people discover what's a better way. You've got to have this process, and this is the way you're going to do it, and so forth, would never work. But facilitating people, sitting down and talking about it, and working it out, does. That's a reasonable, good, modern management style, if you've got capable people. You don't want too much of an authoritarian management. I think we have a unique process that works better here than it would in most companies, but it is tailored to the fact that we have very, very smart people who are very, very motivated. As Microsoft has grown, it has introduced a number of policies to prevent groups from having to continually reinvent solutions to the same problems, but these generally remain as guidelines or principles rather than rigid rules. Brad Silverberg commented on this transition within the company. Back in the early days, you didn't really need rules, but the practices have adapted to fit the new needs. But I think the culture is very strong, firmly entrenched. Decentralization. Keeping things as flexible as possible, but not too flexible. There are some rigid points, but each group adapts to the rules a little differently. Dave Moore or Mike Maples doesn't come to me and say, "You are going to run your development organization this way." It wouldn't work. In the next chapter, we discuss how Microsoft defines job categories, as well as how it organizes and cultivates creative technical specialists. 2. Managing creative people and technical skills. Organize small teams of overlapping functional specialists. To manage creative people and technical skills, Microsoft follows a strategy that we describe as organize small teams of overlapping functional specialists. We break down our discussion of this strategy into four principles. Establish functional specialties, but work in small teams and overlap responsibilities. Let functional experts define and hire for their technical specialties. Educate new hires through learning by doing and mentoring. Create career paths and ladder levels to retain and reward technical people. Establishing functional specialties or career paths and separate promotion ladders for technical people are not unusual policies, though they are especially useful for companies where technology is central to their business. Microsoft, however, seems to be unusual in their degree to which it empowers people in these specialties to define their jobs, hire new people, and train new hires. It also appears to us that Microsoft has relatively little formal orientation and education for a company with so many employees and products. This is both a strength, job categories are flexible and people are independent-minded, and a weakness. People have to learn by trial and error, reinventing the wheel in many cases. Why these principles exist also has much to do with Microsoft's particular history and culture. In its early years, Microsoft consisted primarily of software developers who created and tested new products, made all the hiring, marketing, and contract decisions, and answered telephone calls from customers. As its products and lines of business grew in number and sophistication, the company added thousands of people. The risk and cost of designing the wrong products or delivering them late and with serious errors persuaded Microsoft managers to identify and institutionalize key functional disciplines. To avoid over-compartmentalization of these functions, however, technical specialists have overlapping responsibilities and work in small, multifunctional teams. Program management and software development, as well as testing, are the main technical specialties within the product units. In particular, Microsoft looks for budding super programmers with no dislike of the commercial aspects of the PC software business. They may not be the most innovative programmers in the industry, or be especially knowledgeable about other company practices in software engineering, but they are highly creative in generating new features and products that people buy, and these skills translate into huge revenues and profits for the company. As a result, Microsoft's programmers appear to rank among the most productive and cost-efficient in the industry. Within the product units, program managers, developers, and testers work side by side in small feature teams. These typically consist of one program manager, who generally works on more than one feature, and 3 to 8 developers, one of whom acts as a team leader or lead. There is also a parallel feature testing team, whose members are paired with the developers. User education specialists work as part of the product teams, and product managers staff the division marketing departments and small groups for product planning within the product units. Customer support staff are part of a separate division, but product specialists work closely with the individual product units. Some of the functional areas, such as program management, have remained difficult to define precisely. Others, such as program management and development, program management and product management, and development and testing, cannot be separated too distinctly, and Microsoft does not try. The product units have senior managers in charge of each functional area, such as development or testing. These functional managers work on the feature teams and report to the head of the product unit, who is very much like a project manager as described in other industries, such as automobiles. In the case of the Office product unit, this person coordinates several related projects, primarily Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. Microsoft managers delegate many decisions to the feature teams. Nonetheless, the product unit manager and the senior functional managers make major technical decisions, allocate resources within the constraints of the unit budget, and resolve conflicts among the different groups. They also meet as a group with senior product managers and executives to determine project schedules, milestone targets, and the decision to ship the product. Principle: establish functional specialties, but work in small teams and overlap responsibilities. Microsoft has created tracks for each basic functional area, but it makes people learn broadly and share responsibilities. And it organizes people in small, multifunctional teams that work as part of a larger project team. How it does so in each discipline is described below. Program management. Perhaps the most difficult job to define and fill in Microsoft is that of the program manager. This person must manage the process of product specification and serve as a crucial link between software development and marketing, product management. A company orientation presentation written by a program manager named Bruce Ryan described himself and his colleagues as technical undergrads who drive fast cars and live in their offices. He also cautioned that the program manager is a leader, facilitator, and coordinator, but is not the boss. Ryan goes on to list the key areas of responsibility for program managers as follows: the product's vision, the written product specification, the product schedule, the product development process, all implementation trade-offs, coordination of the product development groups. The origins of the program manager function in Microsoft date back to the mid-1980s. At that time, it had become clear to senior managers that they had to wrest some control over product development from super programmers. It was also apparent that managing the design process differed from developing software. Jeff Rakes, now a senior vice president responsible for marketing, who moved from Apple to Microsoft in 1981, recalled in a 1990 case study the difficulties that super programmers created in Microsoft. "There are a lot of problems with relying on individual superstars. One, they are in very short supply. Two, someone has to maintain and update the software they've written, which often doesn't interest them, and often other people have difficulty understanding their code. Three, sometimes they don't understand what the market wants. And finally, if you try to put several of them on the same project, you get real problems with design decision. Too many cooks spoil the broth." Jabe Blumenthal, who joined Microsoft in 1982 to work under Rakes, helped developers define the vision for the multi-plan spreadsheets and get it to market. In so doing, he served as a role model for what became the job of the program manager. "In early 1984, we began to work on a spreadsheet for the Mac. I got involved and became a sort of service organization for the development group. I helped document the specifications, do the manual reviews, and decide what bug fixes were important and what could be postponed to a later release. While I didn't make the design decisions, I made sure that they got made. The process worked out really well, so they decided to call it something and institutionalize it." Bill Gates supported the decision to formalize the program management function, even though it represented a significant change in how he liked to work. In the early years, he often rewrote nearly every line of code in every product that Microsoft shipped, as well as oversaw product marketing. As discussed in Chapter 1, though, by the mid-1980s, it had become impossible for Gates to oversee everything. He agreed to create formal job categories, such as product managers to handle marketing issues, and then program managers to work in between marketing and development. But Gates did not want program management to become too distinct from development or marketing. He wanted program managers to work side by side with developers in small teams, as Jay Blumenthal had done, both sharing and distinguishing their roles. Without this overlapping and close cooperation, Gates believed, separating the functions would have failed. "We didn't have program management, and developers didn't like making up those big documents and sitting in long marketing meetings. And so there ended up being a new skill set, which is a very leveraged skill set that is able to capture all that stuff. Other people do have program management now, a little bit differently than we do, but I think the whole industry's found that it's an important approach. Program management and development every day are working together. That's the closest relationship in the whole thing, closer than development to testing, closer than marketing to anybody. You could put program management and development under one common manager. In fact, sometimes, if you get the right personalities, we get groups and we do that. But if your program management and development aren't working well together, then forget it. Basically, you're not going to get anywhere." Today, in the initial stages of a new project, program managers work closely with product planners to make sure that each new product has a distinctive vision. Together, they write up a vision statement that incorporates inputs from developers, customer support and other sources, including senior managers such as Gates. Program managers then write up a product specification, which begins in outline form and describes the different features in the product. This document evolves as program managers and developers discuss the details of feature ideas and build prototypes. Each program manager generally oversees the development of more than one feature and thus works as part of more than one feature team. In many companies, it is common to have separate groups of software designers, sometimes called systems analysts or requirements engineers, who write down a functional design for other people, usually called programmers, implementers, or coders, to build. The designers then usually start on a new product, limiting their involvement in projects to just this first phase. Microsoft people insisted to us many times that program managers are not designers in this sense. In contrast, Microsoft program managers remain involved throughout a project because their specifications evolve along with the product. Program managers may spend a lot of time in the beginning of a project to define features common to multiple products, resolve product architectural issues, and sketch out user interfaces, screens or menus that users see on the computer. And they frequently come up with ideas for new features. But they do all these things with the help of developers, who also generate many feature ideas, especially in the systems division. What program managers do, then, is write down the specification rather than create the design. They also work with the feature teams and help manage the project. Chris Peters, Vice President of Office, summed it up. The program manager is responsible for writing down the specification. He's not responsible for all ideas. It's important that it get written down, that one person run that. Gates agreed with this description, emphasizing that developers are really in control of the ultimate design. We can argue about who comes up with the good features, because in some groups it's development, in some groups it's program management. But there's no design, in the sense of how that code works, that's ever done in program management. And development is still in the strong position, let's face it. If they have an idea, they get to write the code. They can say this one's super easy and everything else is super hard. So to the degree that development wants to do design, we love to have them do design. And there are some groups, like in Windows or NT or in the C compiler, most of systems, basically, where development is doing the design and program management is documenting it. Then, when you get over to applications, it is far more balanced in terms of who's doing the design. The healthiest application, because it's always set a model for so many things, is Excel. There, probably 60% of the ideas come from program management, but 40% come from development. Take a guy like John Devon, or some of those feature leads. Those guys are really proud of their features. It's not even easy to say on any particular feature, okay, program management put in the idea for it, development said, okay, we can do this, then they showed it to program management. That's got to be super interactive. Believe that development feels like they own those features and that they care incredibly about those features. Managing the process of specifying and designing the product means that program managers oversee critical activities throughout the project, but have little formal authority over the different groups on whom they must rely to get things done. In addition to the vision statement and specification, for example, program managers take charge of making trade-off decisions, such as which features to include and which to exclude. They often rely on a Microsoft technique called activity-based planning. See Chapter 4. To understand what customers really want to do with a product and determine whether a particular feature accomplishes those tasks efficiently. Also, as part of the design and decision-making process regarding features, program managers build prototypes and oversee the testing of preliminary versions of features or interfaces with novice users in Microsoft's Usability Lab. See Chapters 5 and 6. Program managers are responsible for preparing a preliminary development schedule, based again on inputs from development, testing, product management, and user education. They keep track of progress on the schedule and make sure that developers test features in the usability lab and document them for external users as well as for internal maintenance and testing. They negotiate project milestones with other members of the team, and they work with testing and development managers to determine when coding of features within a milestone is complete, as well as when a product is ready to ship. Program managers also take the lead in coordinating with other groups through formal meetings, daily email messages, and meetings in the hallways or over lunch. This coordination work, which has gained importance in recent years, includes standardizing interfaces among different products or pieces of code that must work together, and synchronizing schedules among different groups that share features and code or are trying to ship their products together. This occurs in the case of Excel, Word, PowerPoint, Access, and Mail, as well as OLE and Visual Basic for applications within the Office suite of programs. In their role as leaders and facilitators, rather than bosses, program managers try to make sure that communication occurs across the functional areas and throughout the development cycle. Developers, product managers, testers, and customer support engineers, as well as senior executives, beginning with Bill Gates, all have inputs into decisions about a new product, which features to keep, or when to move on to the next milestone or to ship. Once people agree on the goals, then, to quote from Microsoft's documents, program management's responsibility is to deliver. John Fine, formerly director of program management and now with the Excel group, described the key jobs of program managers. If program managers didn't exist at Microsoft, I'll tell you what would be different to me, and it's two things. First, program managers make sure the features that get shipped in the product are features that users will actually open their wallets for. It's extremely easy to create a piece of software which is wonderful in all respects, except that the features it has happen not to be features any large group of consumers are interested in. So you could call causing that to happen design management, maybe, depending on the definition of design. The second thing they do is make sure the product actually hits the market at the optimal time with the optimal content. And it is traditionally well known that it's very easy for products to slip or also to ship with too little stability or too much stability. Information about the content of the product is not communicated perfectly between the different team members that are building the software and the documentation and testing the software. The larger the project and the larger the product, the lower the percentage goes. The implication, if that problem isn't solved, is a product will come out with internal inconsistencies. The documentation will say something different than the actual functionality of the product. The functionality of the product will be inconsistent between two different features. The solution is that the program manager has to somehow cause communication to occur. The close connection of program managers to the market, as well as to developers, also creates problems. While they usually help impose more discipline over the development process, program managers sometimes have trouble making the trade-off decisions. One standard quip in Microsoft is that if developers are struggling between two different approaches to implementing a feature, the program manager is likely to suggest they do both. Program managers also tend to create overly long lists of features, which then become the focus of fierce debates as product managers, developers, and executives try to narrow down the options. As Gates noted, developers continue to have a special influence over this selection process, since they must evaluate the technical feasibility of implementing the features. Nor do all program managers have expertise in software design, yet they contribute to decisions that affect the high-level structure, or lack of structure, in Microsoft products, especially applications. Program managers in some groups also tend to become very technical and more concerned with the views of developers than of average users. This occurs most often with operating systems and language products. As Mike Conti, senior program manager for Office, observed, in a lot of groups, It has evolved too much into being a very different, very technical ivory tower position that doesn't have a lot in common with marketing. That's not a good thing for program management or for the product. Development. We quoted Mike Maples in Chapter 1 as saying that developers, officially called software design engineers, walk a little taller than anybody else in Microsoft. In our visits, we observed this to be the case. Program managers generally focus on the vision for the overall product and what types of features make up this vision. Developers, in contrast, define the vision and create the details of individual product features. Steven Sinofsky, Group Program Manager for Office, described succinctly what developers do. They write the code, they implement the features, they know the code base. Their job is to ship products by writing code. We noted earlier that Microsoft developers generally do not receive detailed specifications from program managers and then simply write code. Handing off detailed specs is a style of development once common in large-scale software producers like IBM. Charles Simony also tried to introduce this approach to Microsoft in the early 1980s. It did not take root. Developers usually evolve specs with program managers, then create the details of their own features. Nevertheless, a small number of senior developers and program managers on each project do take charge of the product architecture, and developer leads, first-line managers, provide guidance to their teams. Developers also share responsibilities with testers to make sure the features work. Microsoft literature described the broad and overlapping responsibilities of developers as follows. Determine the vision for new features. Design the features. Allocate project resources. Build the features. Test the features. Prepare the product for shipping. Suggestions for features come from developers, program managers, and other sources. Developers, however, need to clarify what each feature accomplishes and help program managers decide which features to include or cut from a new product. Developers thus need to evaluate each feature and how people might use it. Designing features consists mainly of figuring out what algorithms, computer instructions, might implement the desired tasks. This also involves considering the compatibility of a feature with other features and product versions, and whether it is possible to borrow code from other Microsoft products, an increasingly important concern. Allocating project resources requires developers to estimate how long they think it will take to code each feature. Individual developers make these estimates.